stay connected to the world around you, KPBS brings you trusted news, compelling stories, and in-depth reporting every day. Wherever life takes you, KPBS is here, on the radio, online, and on the go. Discover more at kpbs.org.
You are now listening to Meridian Arts.
The story you're about to hear is true. It takes place in the wild world of rap and contains mature content that may not be appropriate for all audiences. Like N.W.A. said,
parental discretion's advised.
Got a question that makes me wonder about what's the difference between graffiti and hieroglyphics besides a felony offense. The first clue should have been the color on his fingertips.
Peace, y'all. My name is Parker Edison. I'm an artist. I'm fascinated by the impact of rap writers. Hip-hop's 50th anniversary yielded a ton of articles and interviews on the subject. Being the black rap nerd that I am, I started to notice certain cities have something about their contribution that makes them unique. San Diego is one of those cities for a couple of reasons. I played my share of shows all over the country. Many a night has been spent in a van taxi or green room with my crew in a shouting match about where SD sits in the world of rap and why. I tapped in with some of those close friends I've been discussing rap with, and we put together this series to break it down for you. I'ma map the whole thing out, but here's the deal. This isn't the history of hip hop. This isn't a complete timeline, but it is what happened. Some details will be left out. If we talk about the movie Friday, we're talking about Craig and Smokey. Maybe Day Day and Pops. There's lots of people involved, but that's who we follow to find out what happened. Keep that in mind while you're listening. This is about San Diego rap and the incredible way it got where it is today. You ready? Then let's go. This is a San Diego story.
Yo, albums are top to bottoms, I got this piece for y'all.
Writing my name in graffiti on the wall.
Every lyric's my tag, getting up is the call. So I'm
writing my name in graffiti on the wall.
This is what I ignite in the dead of the night. It's like
writing my name in graffiti on the wall.
You already know that I'm tight, so every time I recite, it's like
writing my name in graffiti on the wall.
From El Centro to everywhere, we're Voices del Valle.
Voices del Valle?
Voices del Valle is a teen-produced podcast about coming of age in California's Imperial Valley.
I love Voices del Valle.
On the next episode of Voices del Valle, we will talk with teens about their cheer and soccer championship seasons. I've got to listen to that. Voices del Valle, fresh voices, bold stories made in the valley.
Voices del Valle, find us on KPBS or wherever you get your podcasts.
I exude fresh, remarkable in every way, elude the best, there's no contest on any day. I go back to pager codes and blockbuster videos, a pillar of hip-hop as far as this city goes.
The track in the back brings us smoothly into the year 2015. Produced by Steve Vicious, it's an ode to graffiti art called Fresh Burner. It's from the Audiograph EP by rapper Frosty the Nomadic, real name Chris Whitehead. Frosty gained prominence as a frontman in well-established hip-hop crew, The Icons. He and his fellow MC partner Sketch showcased immaculate skill in the craft of MCing. Writer Jay Smith chopped it up with him about the business of music.
You know, from an outsider's perspective, man, you guys, Icons, you know, had the 2000s on lock. You know what I mean? From where I was sitting, you know what I mean?
Right.
What you kind of touched on it a little bit. What was it about, you know, your sound, your approach, your business acumen, et cetera, that allowed you all to be successful?
Back when we started, you could always tell the local rapper, right? Like, the tape came out, whatever, things had a certain look, the quality wasn't always there, the show wasn't always up to par. So literally what I did is I looked at the industry. It didn't even matter if it was rapper, to be quite honest with you. I looked at what the industry was, what did they do, and then what could I afford to do on my level so that I could look as much like them as possible, so that when you went in the record store, you didn't pass me by just because you were like, that's local. So I have flats up in the stores, boom. I look like every other artist when you walk into a record store. Got that. Go to the counter, you see stickers, boom, we got those. You walk around town, we mobbed and we got taggers, we got us, whatever, we bombed the city. Everywhere you went, boom, boom, boom. Any club, even if we got kicked out, we were hitting up the spot. It was getting bombed. So we tried to be ubiquitous, we were everywhere. And then our packaging, we tried to make look as impeccable as possible. And then last, but most importantly, the quality of the sound of our music, regardless of what you thought of our music, was going to be on point. I wasn't going to put anything out that didn't compete sonically with something that you would hear from a major label.
You mentioned a commercial. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
When we were getting set to drop our third album, Needles Mics, I got the flats out. The stores rocked with it. Blessing. Boom. We were in there. Multimedia was everywhere, and we weren't that savvy yet, but television was still hitting. Rap City was huge. So I found out how to put a commercial together, found out the technology that was necessary, like, you know, what the grade of the tape had to be, what it all goes into that part. And we did that. And we were blessed enough to have enough in the kitty, you know, in the budget to make that a possibility. And I was able to get circulation on Rap City for a month. So for a month, every time you saw Rap City, every single day, you saw Icons.
Damn, I did not know that, man.
Yeah, man.
That's, that's, I got to highlight, man. I got to highlight that one.
Once again, doing things at a Hollywood level. Frosty said basically he hadn't figured out how to get his video on the air, but a commercial was the next best thing. That's incredible. When you realize there are whole wings of record labels dedicated to getting the video on the air, this local rap group was halfway there just by themselves. In contrast to the traditional hip-hop release route taken by others, rapper Adequate, whose real first name is Bethany, employed an unconventional strategy to successfully break into the industry.
You were talking about you toured with Cat Powers. What was that experience like?
What was it like? It was so scary at first. It was intimidating because I would buy her albums for, I think, 8 years prior to me doing a show.
Were you playing like arenas? Were you playing clubs? What was the atmosphere like?
That was the Fillmore in San Francisco.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But it sold out because that's what she'll do, you know. A lot of the feedback was they were like, what is she doing rapping? They thought I was her.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It happened often. Different venues, different years, different albums. Ridiculous.
Do you ever think like you were ahead of your time? You know what I mean? Now that you have like, you know, acts like Doja Cat. Ahead of that, you know?
Yes. We could talk about any song and we could talk about how you could bring that. You just drop it and it would sound like it came out today. I feel like it's like Billie Eilish, like all these contemporary people doing it are a part two. They're the commercialized version. We were the, you know, indie version. It's like every succession, you know, we had to do the grimy work. We had to fight for it.
Tell me I deep sea fish speak. His bumble love thunder on the sea ship. Beat his potent queen. No, I steam and seize. Lift seas, chicks, sweet hips. Focusing on each twitch. Keep all the drama in the bumble. Time to go. Be quick. Sweetness, sugar down. Hook me up, look like I sound. Palm water, love, palm.
I feel like I sound like Bun B, in my opinion. Like, that's what I feel like.
On that song?
Yeah.
Like, listen, you gave me a copy. You gave me a copy years ago. That shit's incredible.
White Leather, right?
Oh, White Leather is incredible. I mean, that's just, that is incredible.
Both Adequate and Frosty recorded much of their catalogs in the early 2000s. But their influences continue to grow over time, and they've extended their artistic lives by re-releasing their underground hits to make them new classics. In a similar vein, across town, a seasoned vet who started releasing music at a young age continues to do so, delivering some of his best work yet. Sir, what's your name and where'd you grow up?
Big June, Southeast San Diego, Skyline area.
Who was a mentor for you coming up in hip-hop culture?
Would have to be Repo Rick. He, at 16, he took me up under his wing. He was the executive producer of my first single. Took me around the world, you know what I mean? I was like 16, 17 years old. By 95, I met like all the artists, you know what I mean? I bumped into Snoop Dogg, DJ Quick, and them. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
Where did you sell your first tapes?
Fanmart. I ain't gonna even lie. Fanmart parking lot. I sold probably over 1,000 tapes in that parking lot alone. Yeah, we was in that parking lot, like, really getting it in. Like, Lil CS, I think he made like $1 million out the trunk sales. Dito Brown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We didn't give a damn about no colors or nothing like that. You know what I mean? Like, it was wartime, but, you know, those that was making money. And, you know, mm-hmm. we salute, you know what I mean, and keep it pushing. Like,
yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm Big Jim, Young G, sporting brown and black. Dickie Sagging, Southeastern printed on my back. You know what I mean?
Like, hey.
And then the world took to that, like San Diego, rather.
Yes. Yes.
They took to it. Every, man, I'd be riding down the street, like National City. I hear people pulling up next to me, bumping it. Like, it was no better feeling than that to me.
What's Footprints?
It actually came from the Footprints poem.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it's basically God carrying us, you know what I mean?
Footprints there, you know what I'm talking about?
There was two
sets of footprints in the sand.
It was then that you carried
me. There was two
sets of footprints in the sand.
John, my
there
was two.
Yeah, the general I done made it through some of my most difficult times, from shootouts to getting caught behind enemy lines.
When Nip died, I seen all the people in LA, like Bloods, Crips, it was over probably 100,000 people in the middle of the street, Bloods, Crips, and everybody. And I just wanted to bring that to San Diego, you know what I mean? Like, so it was just like that, you know what I mean? And then it came from God. It wasn't me that wanted to do it. It was sent to me, you know what I mean? And I just did what I was told, you know what I mean? And then I got the Footprints in the Sand, which is the nonprofit organization we call FITS. Because back in the days, you know, people just be walking and you know the dudes that walk with the meme mug and then they toss their sign up,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
not knowing that he, you know, where he's from, you toss it up, now it's a whole fight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the right pocket and the left pocket was just to let people know I'm wearing this, mm-hmm. but I'm a general, you know what I mean? I'm not tripping off the BS.
Mm-hmm. Hey, this is huge. Traditionally, announcing your gang colors are a way of challenging your opposition. Thusly, refusing to announce your affiliation is a sign of cowardice, an either-or situation. Big June's Footprints clothing made it so people could signify their gang members without being confrontational. I don't know if you understand how big this is. He essentially made a neutral flag both sides could use.
You know, and I just ran off with it. Believing in the Most High, you know what I mean? Like,
right. Right.
If he with you, who can be against you, you know? Wearing those footprints and pushing the way I push is in a positive, you know what I mean? So God was really carrying me through a lot of situations when I had no money. Like, he was putting the ground up under my foot and I was making something out of nothing, you know what I mean? Like some of my homies, they kind of like, I ain't gonna say they backed up off me, but they didn't know what it was for or what it was about. Like, they won't know until their car breaks down in the neighborhood they ain't gonna be in and they let them up out of there, you know what I mean? And they ain't gonna know till then, okay, June was really, really on his, you know, on his stuff. Like,
man, that was deep. Gonna hit a quick break real fast. When you get back, we'll look at a local fight for freedom of speech. Stick around.
This season on Everybody's Doing It with Miss Lolly, I'm going to classes, workshops, and private venues designed to enrich and broaden our sexual horizons, and I'm taking you with me. I meet with an erotic mindfulness coach, get a pelvic floor exam, talk with new moms, and even put on my dancing shoes and take a beginning burlesque class, and much more. Find season 2 of Everybody's Doing It with Miss Lolly wherever you get your podcasts, and come join me in my search for fun and sexy adventures that are available to you.
Welcome back. Ganja Sufi is an original member of the esteemed Masters of the Universe crew, along with rappers Orko Elohim and Odessa Kane. In 2010, his album A Sufi and the Killer made noise on the LA beat scene. He scored a big win in 2013 when Jay-Z closed his album Magna Carta Holy Grail by rhyming over the instrumental to Sufi's Nickels and Dimes.
Nickels and Dimes. My mind. I'm
afraid.
Ganja Sufi is another artist you would have copped at Access Music at that time. If you remember, Access Music was San Diego's flagship hip-hop spot, the number one go-to for backpack rappers and DIY types, an independent record store in Pacific Beach where everyone from true schoolers to left-field outliers could sell their music and merchandise on consignment. And while it was a hot spot during the first decade of the new millennium, it wasn't the only one. On the other side of town, where the freeways box people in southeast San Diego, FamMart, a long-standing indoor swap meet operating since 1985, had music vendors selling local music too.
The street stuff is what they specialized in. Rap music for and by San Diego's G's, hustlers, and gangster rappers.
That's writer Jay Smith. He's deeper in this part of the scene than I am.
Artists like Sick B, Lil B Stone, Lunch Meat, Baylo, Cricket, Lil CS, and Issei Uno held favor, with labels like Grimy Records releasing albums, compilations, and CDs.
The city's second wave of gangster rap was in full swing by the early 2000s, and one of its most popular acts, Wrong Kind Records' Mitchie Slick, would go on to become not only one of the period's most successful rappers, but also one of its most enduring stars. A career 2 decades and counting that began with the release of his debut album, Triggeration Station, in 2001.
I think Triggeration Station is one of those seminal kind of albums. In terms of San Diego rap, it's a classic. It's one of those projects that captures the time and the sound, from the production to the features. It's a perfect distillation of what was going on at that moment. And in a larger sense, I think Mitchie Slick is the perfect embodiment of San Diego, in the same way that Schoolboy Q is L.A., or Goody Mob's Big Gip is Atlanta. They're quintessential prototypes of distinct regional identities. Like here, on Regular Niggin, from Triggeration Station, where Mitchie Slick articulates his hometown makeup via Mexican food and Padres baseball caps.
Regular Southeast like rolled tacos with cheese, like the brown Padre hat with the orange ass D. Right this second, I'm probably in a set cooking up a half a key, and I'll be late to one of my shows if you want more than 10 P's. Cause I keep regular.
Fully agree on all points. Hella accurate. And if we're talking about Mitchie, then this is a good time to introduce you, the listener, to Tiny Dew. Sir, what's your name and where'd you grow up?
Man, my name is Brandon Duncan, when I go by Tiny Dew. I grew up in Southeast San Diego, District 4, to be exact.
How'd you get your start in rap?
My boy, Mike Nitty. He just got out of jail, too. I said, welcome home, Mike Nitty. He just called me one day to the studio, like, hey, man, come to the studio with me. I'm like, bro, I don't know how to rap, you know what I mean? Like, man, I'm telling you, I got you. I'm going to show you how to do this, man. He sat me down, you know what I mean? He taught me how to write bars. He taught me, but then I actually start rapping when I do some Skyline, put my name in a song. Instead of going back over there trying to do something, you know, we make a song too, you know what I mean? Yeah, so keep the BS off the streets, you know what I'm saying? We kept it on wax, you know what I'm saying? And I made a song back, and the song that I made, I guess, was, you know what I'm saying, pretty dope or whatever. So it was catching the ears of different people, you know what I'm saying? And then Mitchie Slick ended up hearing one of the verses that I did. From there, it just progressed, and, you know, I never stopped, you know what I mean? I just kept going. Yeah.
Who, if anybody, were you listening to locally at that time?
Local. Big June. I was big on Big June. I love Big June's raps. Of course, J.O., you know, here and there. But I was super big on East Coast music. You know what I'm saying? I never was really too into, other than the norm, like Snoop Dogg and Ice Cube and, you know, the norm. But I'm a big, like, East Coast buff, like Benny Siegel. I like what I call bully rap. Benny Siegel, M.O.P., Lloyd Banks, 50, you know what I'm saying? Them is like my dudes, Fab. I'm kind of like big on that, punchlines and bars, you know what I'm saying? That's where I come from. Yeah, that early 2000s era, you know what I mean? When them bars is intact, yeah.
Do you think San Diego produces backpack rap or gangster music?
That's the beautiful thing about San Diego. We do it all. So you can get the backpack rap and you can get the gangster music. With Dago, we have a little bit of everything. It's like a melting pot, you know what I'm saying? Because we got dope back. Oh, that's a Kane. Mm-hmm. Come on, man. Park Edison. Come on, man. Let's go. Like we have it all, which is beautiful, you know what I'm saying? So it's like whatever you want, you can get from San Diego.
What was FamMart?
Home, man. That's where you get all your stuff from, man. That's where we used to sell all our CDs till we got shit. You used to take the CDs and send you after you print it up. You know what I'm saying? You got your stuff, your CDs is ready to go, man. You go up to Fanmar, Shin buy the beat. If he gonna buy a box. If you dope, Shin buying the box, right? He want a whole box. He might want 2-3 boxes if you dope. But if you ain't dope, he gonna tell you give me 5 and he'll holler at you later. You know what I'm saying? So that was the spot to go to sell your CDs, to get your t-shirts, to get your, you know what I'm saying, your fresh kicks. You know what I mean? Anything that you needed, you know what I'm saying, you can get from Fanmar. Remember, I don't know if you remember Dito Brown. Remember Dito Brown?
Yes, sir.
Come on, bro. Dito Brown had the most hustle I ever seen in my life, bro. His crew was so, they was, I'm talking about savage when it came to selling his music, man. Shouts out to Dito Brown, man.
Bruh, he tells about selling a million out the trunk.
That part, and I guarantee you he really did that. He ain't put no extras on it. He probably sold a few million, bro, because he used to be grinding, bro. Dito was, man, I'm talking about, he had his little sons, and everybody had their own CD, and they was selling CDs, man.
How come San Diego hasn't had more major label success?
Business. We don't have the infrastructure to help us navigate through hip-hop in that sense. There's no labels. There's no major labels in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, you take a New York, you know what I'm saying? You take L.A., you know, they have all the major labels there. You know, I feel like that keeps us from being at that, you know, that high position in hip-hop. You know what I mean? That's why I spend so much time in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can run into the people that you need to run into. You can talk to who you need to talk to. You know what I mean? Like, just being out there, and you know what I'm saying, where, you know, plays is called. So you just keep sitting in a room, bro, and you know what I'm saying? Exhibit might turn around and say, hey, bro, you got something for this? You know what I'm saying? That's how I ended up on his album. You know what I mean?
You just kind of buried the lead on that. On whose album?
On Exhibit's. Okay. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I got a a record on Exhibit's new album produced by Rick Rock.
What's the Close Your Ears documentary?
A documentary about the First Amendment, like hip hop, people going to jail for their rap lyrics, and just basically told my story on, you know, everything that happened to me as far as me going to jail for the 182.5, basically being kidnapped, which is what I call it. I was kidnapped by the city of San Diego, stuck in jail for 8 months over rap lyrics. I was Juneteenth, and crazy day, right? That's the day they come grab up, 15 black males in a gang conspiracy case.
On 619, which is the area code for San Diego, 619.
And it was Juneteenth, you know what I'm saying? Come on, so it gets deep. So they came and grabbed us up on that day, threw us in jail, told me I was basically being held for murders and shootings, that they didn't have a shooter for these cases because they felt like, you know, Linkin Park had something to do with it, and I was a documented gang member, I could be held liable for those crimes. Yeah, I stayed in jail for like 8 months. Yeah.
So the listener understands, the weapon, was it the gun that they were saying that you had?
No, the gun in my sense was a mixtape called No Safety, which had a cover. The cover had a gun on the cover, you know what I'm saying? Which was a metaphor, obviously, because they didn't know it was a revolver, which a revolver has no safety. Right. So you don't know our culture, and you're trying to, you know, depict our culture to be a negative when really it's just a metaphor, bro. It's a gun with no safety on it.
Wow.
I used that and said basically the stuff that I was talking about in this music was gang related, and I had made a bunch of money off of a free mixtape.
Wow.
Right, so that's what 182.5 is. It's basically a state RICO case, yeah.
U.S. prosecutors have used rap lyrics in criminal cases before. In 1989, Broward County, Florida attempted to ban Two Live Crews, As Nasty As They Wanna Be, for obscenity. The case reached the Supreme Court in 1994, where it ruled in favor of Two Live Crew, recognizing the value of protecting music as free speech under the First Amendment. This line of litigation is particularly frightening, as it seems to become more damaging with each iteration. What started as an obscenity case in the 90s has ramped up to racketeering by Brandon Duncan's case. Less than a decade later, rapper Young Thug is indicted because of his rap lyrics. Fortunately, his case has jump-started the conversation about the unjust scrutiny rappers face.
Could you do me a favor and could you introduce Deserve This from the RTC?
Oh man, so this is Deserve This, a song that I did when I first got out of jail or whatnot, and I just wanted to again, paint that picture and tell the story on. I was asking the prosecutors, like, what did I do? You know what I'm saying? Basically, to deserve the situation, you know what I'm saying, you was putting me in, which I knew what I did, you know what I'm saying? It's in my melanin. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. That part.
Sheesh. I'm about to play it right now.
Let's do it.
What I do to deserve this? Mixing and rhyming words, talking how I seen them brains left on the curb. Talking about the flights, the nights, cooking the birds. Goddamn, they only words. What I do to deserve this?
Eat shot like 3 in the morning. You would think I left my mother in mourning. Got my flick all in the news, looking crazy in County Blues. DA going in like a caught your boy with the tool. When the truth is, I was rhyming about the place I was born. Cause anything less than me.
From Meridian Arts and KPBS, this is episode 11 of Rap Diego, a San Diego story. The last episode of our season introduces you to the latest generation of talent.
Because back in the day, not a lot of people had studios. Now it's like everybody has a studio. I have a studio in my house, you know? And it's like back day, you really had to find somebody that had the equipment or even knew how to run the equipment.
Rap Diego is a co-production of KPBS and Meridian Arts. Host and co-creator, Parker Edison. Episodes written by Jay Smith, Chris Reyes, Don Jegger, and Stephen Flex. Extra special thanks to guest writer Melody Harold. Editing by Platform Collection. Music soundtrack by Monday Adams. Executive producer for KPBS is Lisa Jane Morissette, KPBS Director of Audio Programming and Operations. Technical and operational support provided by KPBS technical producer, sound designer, Adrian Villalobos, and KPBS producer, Julio Ortiz Franco. This programming is made possible in part by the KPBS Explore Content Fund. Shout outs in no particular order to Broken Dreams, Lyrical Schoolyard, ALO, Cypher One, The Federals, Dago Braves, Old English, Liquid, and Napalm Funk. See y'all soon.
Now playing Chill Bill by Rob Stone, 2016.
Figuring out the right sport for your kid can feel overwhelming. I'm taking that journey with my son, Dorian, exploring different sports and revisiting the fields that I grew up playing. Together, we're searching for the right fit and maybe reconnecting with a few old memories along the way. It's Game Time Decision, a new series from KPBS. Join us at kpbs.org/gametime.